Open your Bibles to the third chapter of James, please. Our speech always does something to everyone who hears us say it, and to us also. That's really the point that James is making here. And in England, there's a gravestone. I've not seen a picture of the gravestone, but I know what's written on it. It says, "Beneath this stone, a lump of clay, lies Arabella Young, who on the 24th of May began to hold her tongue." Now, the chapter divisions in the Bible are oftentimes arbitrary. We know that. You know, when James wrote the book, he did not say this is a big number three starting here. They were added much later. But in this case, it is an accurate delineation between two separate thoughts. And oftentimes, the very first part gets overlooked because we're all very familiar with this passage about the tongue. I don't think there's a single person in here that would say they've never read this before. But we oftentimes skip over the very first verse and lose a little bit of the information that James is actually given to us in the audience that he's talking to. I would like to read the entire, or us to read the entire passage at one time. Chip McChristian, would you read 1 through 12 for us, please?
"Not many of you should presume to be teachers, my brothers, because you know that we who teach will be judged more strictly. We all stumble in many ways. If anyone is never at fault in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to keep his whole body in check. When we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal. Or take ships as an example. Although they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boast. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole person, sets the whole course of his life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and creatures of the sea are being tamed that have been tamed by man, but no man can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil, full of deadly poison. With the tongue we praise our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in God's likeness. Out of the same mouth come praise and cursing. My brothers, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water."
Now, the previous chapter, James has been addressing behavior and works, not works versus faith, but works that demonstrate faith. And the implication is there were people that were saying one thing and doing another. They were saying they were believers, but they were not. They were saying, do this, but then they do something different. He is discussing behavior in this part of his epistle here. "My brethren, let not me become teachers." Any of you have a translation that says masters? Yeah. A teacher, a master, a rabbi, the way this is translated, it determines someone who is on a higher plane, a higher social status, someone that the rest of us are minions and subjective to. That's probably an exaggerated example in our experience, but in their world, that was very apt. Teachers in the first century were more like overseers. The people, it's not like in our society, where Gene can stand up and say, "I think you're wrong." You just didn't do that. If the teacher was in a church or a synagogue and said, "This is the way it's supposed to be done," he was working ostensibly from an entire unwritten commentary or code on the law of Moses. They had been debated over centuries. And he had the weight of this behind him. And there was no reprieve. There was no discussion. That was the way their mindset was. And then along came these churches, and suddenly people were accepting the validity that God sent his son, that he died and rose from the dead, that the law was to be done away with by that, that our sins could be forgiven, the debt could be paid merely by asking and receiving forgiveness. This was a new thing, but the old ways of thinking were still there. Matthew 15:14, read that for us, please.
Let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind. And if a blind man guides a blind man, both will fall into the pit.
And who is speaking here? And who is he speaking of?
The Pharisees,
the rabbis, teachers. Matthew 23:1-12.
Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must be careful to do everything they tell you. But do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy, cumbersome loads and put them on their people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Everything they do is done for the people to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels on their garments long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogue. They love to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to be called rabbi by others. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher, and you are all brothers. And do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father, and he is in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Messiah."
1 Corinthians 1:12-13.
"Now, this I say, that every one of you say, 'I am of Paul, and I am of Apollos, and I of Cephas, and I of Christ.' Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Or were you baptized in the name of Paul?"
1 Corinthians 3:11-15.
"For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. If anyone's work which he has built on it endures, he will receive a reward. If anyone's work is burned, he will suffer loss. But he himself will be saved, yet so as through fire."
Now, teachers are not supposed to be vain or pompous. They're only supposed to teach what is right and what is true. They're not supposed to desire a position because of the perks that go with it. Are you aware today in Israel, modern Israel, up to one-third of the military-age males are exempt not only from serving the military, but having to work? They're actually supported by the government because they are in rabbinical studies. They're learning to be masters. They're learning to be teachers. One-third in some of the villages in Israel, the people, they say, "I won't be a preacher, so you have to pay me for it." And that's the way society is this day. I don't think it's quite that bad here. And we have to be a little careful. We're reading out and trying to dig the implication out of a 2,000-year-old document that is a different culture from ours. But we need to do the best we can to understand and not just say, "Well, that sounds good if I apply it like this," because that's not necessarily the way God intended it to be applied. Let's continue, for we all stumble many things. Now, James is the ultimate in, he doesn't argue, he gives examples. He says we and I a lot, because he's not wanting to offend. He's wanting to show that we all are in this together. "For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in a word, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body." Now, who's perfect? Please raise your hand right now. Paige, keep your hand down. Anybody else? Anybody else? Okay. I've talked to Bill. I know what about Paige. "Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths and may obey us, and we turn the whole body." See, this is an illustration that everybody knows. "Look also at ships. Although they are so large, they're driven by fierce winds. They are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires." Again, another illustration. A small thing guiding a larger thing. "Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a force a little fire kindle." Again, another illustration. A fire raging out of control. Now, the tongue does not guide our lives. We are not slaves to our tongue. Why is he making such a big deal about our speech? Because, you know, you don't think of your tongue, you think of your brain, right? And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature and set on fire by course of hell. This word hell, by the way, I understand, is a transliteration of the two Hebrew words for Gehenna. Where was Gehenna? Anybody remember that?
Wasn't it outside Jerusalem?
It was out in the Valley of Hinnom, outside Jerusalem. What happened in the Valley of Hinnom in ancient days?
Burned the gardens. Well,
they burned the gardens in Christ's time. Why was it used as a refuse dump? Why did nobody build houses? It was prime real estate. Why didn't somebody go down there and build a palace or a mansion or a McDonald's or whatever they built back then? This is where Molech worshipers would burn their children in ancient days. When Christ is using an example of hell to the people he's speaking to, he would literally point at Valley of Gehenna, at Hinnom, and call it Gehenna, where the fire is never quenched and the worm never dies. That was his example to the people of what hell was like, a place of just trash, refuse, a place you would not ever want to go, a place where degrading things were done. That's the same word that's being used here. And it's set on fire by hell. What exactly is we talking about when we say the tongue? I mean, it's not just a physical thing. Did you know your tongue is the only part of your body that has a bone that's not connected to another bone in your body? I knew Chip at Christian would appreciate that, so I thought I'd throw that in. Is the fastest healing part of your body. What was encompassing when we read this tongue? What do we understand that he's talking about? What do you use your tongue for?
Speech.
Can this be considered to be all communication that you use? This is a metaphor for all communication. How else can you communicate?
Right.
Now, most of y'all had children. You know, you say something in a light and they kind of cut their eyes at you. They're communicating to you, aren't you? Or you walk by somebody and they look at you, kind of raise their tongue, sniff a little bit. That's communicate something to you also, right? Or you say hello to somebody and they say, "Oh, how are you?" They immediately turn around and continue what they're doing. That communicates something to you. How about this phrase here? You ever heard this? "Oh, bless his heart, but..." Now, that's a southern way of cutting the legs out from under somebody in a polite manner. I recall, I'm going to tell another story of Mr. McKay here. I was fairly young. I was probably 16, 17 years old. And he was at the barn, and I think he hit his thumb with a sledgehammer. I forget what it was, but I remember it hurt a lot, you know. And I kept waiting for the explosion, you know. And he said, "Goodness gracious, goodness gracious." That impressed on me, because the men I knew would not say "goodness gracious" when they smacked their thumb with a sledgehammer. They'd say a lot of things. Yeah. I recall some of the men that I've worked with and lived with, and some of the ladies also, when they're angry, the kind of speech that they use is vulgar or profane. My uncle was a colonel in the Air Force. And him and my parents would play cards. I think it was bridge. I really don't know. I was a pretty little boy. And when you got a really good hand, you knew it, because the word, it would immediately escape from his lips. He was communicating there. If we could understand this, it's not just the sound that comes out of our mouth, but the communication we're projecting to the world around us. I'm more satisfied that is what the point James is getting across here now. No man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. Now, the previous chapter, again, what has James been decrying? Come on. This is a test. Somebody tell me. The previous chapter, I'll give you a hint, faith and works. What has James been talking about in his letter? Barbara, you look like you just got an answer.
Well, he was
He was referring back to the prejudices that they had from the previous chapters and how they would prefer certain people and that. So he was telling them that their works should be shown, their good works should be shown by their faith. And that obviously they weren't showing that, his chapter's example.
Yeah, show me, you know, your works by faith. I'll show you my faith by my works. You know, this is what you see is what I am. I will show you what I am by what I do. I will show you what I am by what I communicate. Make no mistake, everything you communicate is a demonstration to the world what you are. And everything you communicate has an effect on who you're communicating with. Whether you be friendly, whether you be unfriendly, whether you be interested, uninterested, whether you be overbearing or whether you be kind, whether you're demonstrating selfishness or whether you're demonstrating kindness. Every word that comes out of your mouth, every communication, every gesture, every body posture is communicating something. What is your intentions? Our character is revealed by our speech. Out of the same mouth proceed blessings and cursing, my brothers. Things ought not to be. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? All right, who has Psalms 141:3? Would you read that, please?
Set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips.
Romans 3:10-11, 13-14.
As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. Verse 13, their throat is an open sepulcher, and their tongues they have used, with their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness.
Boy, that's kind of chilling. An open grave, deadly snakes. Matthew 12.
And I say to you that every careless word that men shall speak, they shall render account for it in the day of judgment. For by your words you shall be justified, and by your words you shall be condemned.
Matthew 12:34. This is one of my favorite ones here.
O generation of vipers, how can ye, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaketh.
Now the implication is that the churches that James writes to had too many self-appointed teachers, too many pompous teachers, too many erroneous teachers. Too many teachers want to be teachers just because they wanted the position. That's the implication that we receive from this. Now, the tongue doesn't really control the body. It does reveal what and how we think. For example, profanity. What does that reveal about a person?
The lack of education.
Yeah, that's very good. That is very good. You want to express yourself in strong emotions, and you don't have the vocabulary to do it without using profanity. What else does it communicate about somebody?
Their temperament at the time, I would say, you know, how they feel about what's going on.
Oh, yeah. It can demonstrate very strong emotion. How about impiety or selfishness?
Anger.
When you hear somebody using profanity, usually those are things that I get from it. I never heard my father use profanity. No, I never did. My mother, I never heard. My uncles, I know when they're out, you know, out in the barns or something and got swatted in the face with a nasty tail or something, you know, or had a cow that kept sticking her head under barbed wire and lifting and fought 4 or 5 posts up. Then occasionally you'd hear a mild profanity from. It wasn't until I joined the Navy that I knew what profanity really was. And boy, did I. That was a cultural shock. How about backbiting? Will we include that in the tongue? Talking behind somebody's back. What does that tell you about a person that backbites? Or does the, oh, bless their heart when they aren't?
Somebody down and build themselves up.
Jealousy, etc. How about lying? What does that tell you about somebody?
Your politicians.
Well, now we know Mr. McKay's opinion of politicians. All right. We know how he feels about that. He's communicated to us. Laziness would be one. Yeah. Did you do that? Yes, I did. I'm going to do it. I haven't done it yet, but I'm about to do it. You know, or dishonesty. How about tale-bearing? Not necessarily lying, but going around and say, did you know? I don't want to be bearer of bad news, but, you know, I really need, I'm going to tell you this anyway, even though I probably shouldn't. All right. And you know what I heard? What does that tell you about the person? Yeah, it's a desire for self-importance, small-mindedness, cruelty even. Now, Proverbs 12:18. Who? Yes.
We got the Christian version of tale-bearing.
Yes.
We really need to pray for.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah. That's a good one, especially if they're sitting right there in the pew. There was my sister and brother-in-law. They got a little church, and they actually had one members of the congregation belonged to an organization that pastor had read a book about how evil they were. So the pastor starts preaching and decrying membership in this organization while the member's sitting literally in the second pew in front of them. And the second member had enough of it and stood up and started pointing fingers at a shouting match right there during the worship service. That's a lot of communication. That's describing a lot of things to everybody, not just present, everybody heard it. Even now, as I relate the story, it's communicating something to us. Proverbs 16:24, who has that?
Pleasant words are a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones.
Lady?
There is one who speaks rashly like the thrust of a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing.
We've so far only talked about the bad things that the tongue causes. But the good things are even greater, really. Because the way we relate to each other is through communication. We're not living in a glass tube bumping up at each other and not interacting. We are made by God to interact. In every way, that's the way we are. We are social creatures. God didn't make us like the amoebas with no conscious thought and no interaction. We do have an effect on each other in the way we look at each other, the way we speak to each other, the way we relate to each other, the way we pay attention to each other or do not. And we can not only do great harm, we can do great good. We can lift up. We can exhort. We can support. That is the better thing that the tongue offers. That is the fresh water that James is talking about. That is the tamed animal that James is talking about. Not the forest fire, not the salt water, the good things. Now, James says, no one can tame the tongue. My grandfather would say, you know, son, you can say more in 5 seconds than you can take back in an entire lifetime. And much to my chagrin, that I've proved that on several occasions. I really have. Thoughtlessly saying things or acting in a way that wounded a relationship that I could never repair, ever. It's ironic that I'm the one that gets to teach this, because if anybody has a problem with their tongue in this room, it's probably me. I'm by nature, I'm not much of one to be subservient. I don't say that in pride at all. But from that, an early age, I've always pretty much done my own thing, whether it be professionally or socially or whatever. I've rarely had any supervisors except for a brief period of time. I was always the guy who said, go do this, and I had to figure out how to do it. You understand that? And that contributes somewhat. I had some very strong-willed parents, so genetics probably played a part of it. Yeah. I've also... so... it's not that I have such high opinion of myself. I'm used to being the guy who has to solve the problems. You know, all my life it's been, hey, I need you to fix this, right? What are we going to do here? We can't do that. And it's always been on me to figure a thing out. So when we sit there in a committee meeting and nobody's saying anything, my instinct is to say, we got to do this. If we're sitting in a group looking at a thing on the floor, my instinct is to say, well, this is how we're going to fix it. And when my wife keeps telling me, Chip, stop trying to fix stuff. Chip, don't say anything. You know, back there, Acacia should reach out and put her hand on my knee and squeeze real hard. So it's not just that I'm using profanity or that I'm using impious words or cutting someone down. It's the problem I have is just not knowing when to be quiet. Yes?
I was going to say I have a little bit of that tendency myself, and I think it comes from the fact that I want completion. In other words, you know, you're sitting around with 12 people, and like you say, nobody's
saying,
come on, let's get this.
Let's get it done. Yes. Yes, that's right. We're 2 miles and 1 accord on that gear.
Well, when I was an engineering guy, I learned it because nobody wanted to commit themselves, because if they did, then they knew that they had a job they had to do because they opened up their mouth and made a statement. So somebody's going to say, well, then go do it, you know.
I never had that problem at my mouth of making a statement. I will grant you that. A genre in science fiction is time machines. Now, frequently, I've had people say, boy, I wish I could go back to high school days. I had so much. It was just so wonderful. It was a great time of my life. And I'm thinking, are you nuts? And then I got thinking one day, you know, if I could go back to, say, 14 years old, think of all the things I could leave unsaid, all the people whose feelings I could unhurt, all the relationships I could unwound, the things I said that made my mother and father angry, the things I did that made people think, what a jerk. I could not do those. I'm not going to presume that anybody here shares that view. But that is the history of my Christian testimony, is wounding people with my words and my actions or my inactions. And it stresses me to this day. Let's go on. Now, James 1, 26 through 27 is just applicable in the third chapter as is in the first chapter. Who has that?
Those who consider themselves religious and yet do not keep a tight rein on their tongues deceive themselves, and their religion is worthless. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world.
It is very easy to pick up communication from the world around us also. Because we are inundated. Unless you put yourself in a conclave where you're exposed only to safe communication. And there are people who believe this is what you should do. You should literally stay on a campus or a business or a camp or a neighborhood where you're safe. The world cannot influence you. Well, of course, Satan loves that, because essentially you removed yourself from our great commission, which is to be a witness to the world. You cannot be physically separate and do what we're supposed to do as Christians. You just can't. So the effect is that we are constantly being communicated to ourselves by the world. We are seduced by the world every time you turn on TV or radio or see a billboard ad on the side of the road. You walk into a store, you have the magazine racks there, even the products themselves. I did not realize that the way to get really, really attractive girlfriends in multiple forms is to drink beer until I saw an ad on TV. I thought, wow. You know, of course, that's not the case. But that's the exposure that we have. I'm reminded of Mr. Wilkins, who was our ninth grade homeroom teacher, Ron Wilkins. And he was in the Air Force. And he made a point saying, you know, all those years I was in the Air Force, I never adopted the language of people around me, but I thought it. It became an inescapable part. We are going to have things in our heads that we take in through our eyes and our ears that are poisonous. We know that. That's a part of living in a corrupt creation. It is the onus is on us to make sure what we emit is holy, is kind, is true. That is what James is talking about here. And these teachers were not doing that. These teachers were puffed up. They were vain. They were pompous. They didn't care for anything but themselves. We have to be better than that. We have to be what God desires. All right, questions, observations?
Well, you're not alone in your confession, I assure you.
That's right.
Yes, Andrew.
I think it's true that we usually err by talking too much and saying the wrong thing, but there's also another side that we do need discernment, because there is a time to speak. I was thinking about a book written, I think, by Larry Crabb called The Silence of Adam. And the point being that what if Adam had spoken when Eve had taken the fruit? Apparently he was right there with her and said nothing. And so there is a time that we have to have discernment, because it is probably be a sin not to speak. So I'm just giving you a sign there.
Good. Anybody else? Yes, Darrell.
Earlier in James it said, be swift to hear, slow to speak. If we'd stop and think before we speak, a lot of times, you know, we'd solve that problem. But the other thing, too, is, you know, we're exposed to language and all kinds of things in the world. Someone said, I don't know who it was, said that, you know, you can't stop the birds from flying overhead, but you can prevent them from building a nest in your hair. And so those thoughts are going to maybe go through our mind, but if we can get them out of there before they transfer into action or words.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Don. Having come to Christ in middle age, I guess, 42, I came from a very messy world. And so I was very much familiar with that world, and I was not familiar with the church at all. And when I got in the church, I read the New Testament for the first week I was there, and I didn't come to Christ in the church, it was outside. But at any rate, one of the things that I found is that, and I still have disagreements on what I read in the scripture and what I see in real life. Mm-hmm. And one of the more rare things that I ran across that I needed most was male intimacy, men with men. Mm-hmm. And I look around me today, I'm fortunate in this church, we have that kind of relationship with a number of people and so on, but it's still very rare, and it shouldn't be. But it has to do with the combination of I'm already guilty, and I'm very vulnerable on these things, and I don't dare open my mouth, I'm going to make a mistake. And you can see it in men, and they demonstrate it, and to get close, you know, the more of you there are, the harder it is to get intimate. We have little groups of two and three and so forth. Where that, I'm almost convinced that's why the Lord said we're two or three are together. You know, I'm with you there. I'm with you if you're there for that purpose. And it's the greatest thing out there. But it is such a pervasive problem that even in that early church, I'm convinced it was all interactive. Like a synagogue, where, you know, if Paul or Peter or somebody would go to the synagogue, the first thing they do, they get to a town, and they were asked to speak. Mm-hmm. And it was there was a lot of back and forth. And when the Christians came on the scene, and Paul was to go to the Christians as an accomplished Jew, mm-hmm. he still went to the synagogue always first until almost the very end. But with that kind of communication, and the men were inclined to do that much more in those days than I think. And it's great, still a great way to teach. You know, good teaching. I've been in classes where two or three questions and the thing was taken care of. You could have stayed there a week. But that's not used today. Today we lecture, and all of us do it. It's not, I'm not condemning anything on that, other than the fact that it is different culturally.
It is.
But to go back to this idea of men talking with men, you've got to be extremely careful. I've seen a man, a fine Christian person, make one comment, especially if females are involved in the discussion at all. One comment, destroy that thing for forever. And he never get back in that group. Anyway, it's a fascinating subject. It's a heavy subject, and James does a great job at pointing to these things and the cultural problems that are there. I think the devil uses this more than any other item. And it's why you can't get men to do things in churches and so forth. And so on, goes on and on and on. And there's a lot of cowardice in it among brave men. You just can't get away from it.
Good. Anybody else? Yes, Barbara.
I think it's great that he spends so much time and shows how important of a subject it is, because it's so easy to think of, well, it was just a little lie or just this little thing slipped. Or, you know, I just said that, but I didn't really mean it. That this is really an important problem, and the effects of what we say is very profound, what can happen afterwards. But it's a good reminder that we need to be thinking before we speak, and not just quick to fill up the emptiness or the quietness just talking.
Sometimes it's difficult. You know, the problem is you think too much. You start thinking, and you're still thinking while they're still talking, they're still doing, and you're starting to boil, maybe seethe. And it's not that you don't think enough, it's that you don't think widely enough. And by the time you finally, your turn finally comes to speak or do, you predetermined your actions and speech back here when the situation is right here. That can be a problem. I'll give you an example. Somebody comes up to you and says, I am having, and let's say it's an emotional difficulty with this, and this happened. And you're thinking, well, they're just too soft. They got to toughen up. And they're giving you a list of things that have led to this emotional problem for them, and you're not listening to that. You're still thinking, you wimp. And when it comes time your turn to talk, you're not considered all the ramifications. That's a very short, small example of how we are not wise in what we communicate, not wise in what we speak. And that is a very real example there that I have experienced off just a couple of weeks ago. One of those things I had to repent and apologize for. Now, we all are fallible. And that's the point James is making. So we're not perfect. We can't be perfect. But we're constantly striving. That is our goal. You know, we're not aiming to be third. We're not aiming to be better than average. Our goal is to be like Christ, which is perfect, even though we know we can never attain. It's like I was using a certain member in this audience last Wednesday in Awana as an example of someone I could never defeat, no matter what game or contest I played. I could never defeat them. But it was okay. I wasn't angry with them. And, you know, they didn't lord it over me.
I did not.
But, of course, we were communicating. Everybody saw us in this. We were communicating Christian brotherhood. You know, there was a little trash talking, most of me though. But it was in good fun. Everybody knew this, as opposed to someone who really, really, really hates their enemy, their opponent. Somebody who really, really, really snubs those that they feel are lesser than them. the defeated. Yes, Bear.
Yeah, I noticed how quickly you got off of politics a while ago, but our daily bread last week opened up the first chapter of James, not the second or third. And I read it, and I read it again. Shortly thereafter, I heard Lainey talking about how upset she was with both Democrats and Republicans with all of their discourse lately. And so I went in and I said, oh, you got to grab one James. So I invite Sunday school today, if you just get thoroughly just uptight with all of the rhetoric that's going on with the Democrats and the Republicans, you ought to reread 1 James, because it's addressed in there quite well, better than most of us do.
Well, I would agree. The current political campaign is, the impression I get is immaturity. I don't know if we want any of these schmoes to be president of the United States. I really don't. But what are we supposed to do as Christians? We're still required to pray for them. Whoever winds up being president of the United States is placed there by God. We have to acknowledge that. As galling as it might be, God knows what he is doing. Nebuchadnezzar was in place by God. Cyrus the Great was foretold and placed by God. Even the Roman emperors, from Nero and Caligula, all the way up to Constantine, whether they be good or whether they be bad, this was not God slipping up and letting an evil one get into position. This is not God making a mistake and the wrong president getting elected. And we act like it is sometimes. It doesn't mean you agree with what they do. Certainly Nero was not a Christian at all. Diocletian was not a Christian at all. They were not. Nebuchadnezzar, he became some kind of a believer. We know that. But God uses these people in his will. God used President Obama. Now, I can see right there, some people, the hair rose up on the back of their neck as soon as I said that. But it is a fact. He used Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the one that ushered in the socialist philosophy of federal government. He used Lyndon Johnson, who brought in the Great Society. He used Richard Milhouse Nixon, who is responsible for many of the modern, the EPA, the Clean Water and Safety Acts, and also had resigned in disgrace. He used all the presidents that we have had to sometimes, we would say, suffer under. That doesn't mean we aren't supposed to make a wise choice.
Touching back on what Don was saying, with men, too, and goes on in James to confess our faults one to another. For men to confess these things, it's a sign of weakness that we think, and it makes it very difficult for men to acknowledge that they're lacking in some way. And I don't know how to get at the root of that other than what we're trying to do here.
That is difficult. Because you don't want to turn to a New Age sensitive kind of guy. Yeah, you don't want to do that. I recall, he was a plumber, lived out in Edwall. I worked with his oldest son. And he taught his son, a man never lies, never admits he's wrong, and never says he's sorry. That's how he lived by. Now, you might say, oh my goodness, but most of the men in my grandfather and father's generation would live by that. They would not admit they're wrong. Yes, Don.
A lot of people don't even recognize that the world, in the world, men bond by insulting each other.
Yeah, that's very true.
There's nothing better than to say, you old horse thief. You know, you don't want to smile. But it's not a good thing to be a horse thief anytime. Yeah, but these are the kinds of things that men are making good points with each other with that kind of style based on what we're talking about.
Yeah, I found that out early in my marriage. That doesn't work with women. Right? You know, that's very true. Because men, they bond by what they do with each other. And it's kind of a combative relationship. And it's stressful. It wears you out. Whereas women bond by how they relate to each other and what they say. And boy, I have a steep learning curve. All right, so Gary, you had your hand up first and in.
I just used the word pride. And that was one of the things the Lord hated, I think, the most, was pride.
Pride.
And we're talking about that with, it's just a different definition of all this topic right here. Is by doing something, you know, and pretending that it's all okay, and never admitting that we're wrong. It's just pride. It's all it is.
Yes, Ann.
Well, I was just sitting here thinking, you know, we're so quick to talk or get our point across when you said you sit there and listen to somebody and you've already decided the answer to their question or whatever, because you're not really listening to them. Mm-hmm. I think the example that Jesus gave us was one of great advantage because he knew each and every one of us, and he knew what brought us to that point. And I think sometimes if we tried very hard to not condemn as much as think, what would cause this person to think like this? You know, what has their life been like? And that would afford us better compassion and a better listening to what they have to say. Instead of so quick to jump and, you know, slice them to death, it'd be nice to just sit there and think what has brought them to this point. Jesus had a great advantage. He knew every day of everybody's life. That's and true. That does bring compassion.
The old adage that your mama told you, if you can't think anything nice, don't say anything at all. Yes.
I think these verses in James just remind us that we're sinners. Say we're not perfect yet because we've been redeemed, but we don't have that perfect body. We don't have that perfect mind. And what comes out in our tongue is a reflection of our heart condition. And so the way to have the best control of what we say is to be as spirit-led and controlled as possible, because the wrong things we say are from a heart, the flesh, the sinful flesh response, instead of the Holy Spirit-led response. And so that is a factor. And I think, personally, it's what convicts me more than probably anything in my whole life. It's the thoughts that come into my mind that remind me that I'm a sinner saved by grace. And without the grace of God working in me day by day, I'm not going to reflect Christ. I'm going to reflect His flesh.
Yes, Chip.
Well, one of the problems, I think, for all of us, maybe more so for men, but I think it happens for women too, is the when we are in a recurrent situation, like a work environment, or like in your case, in the Navy, I mean, you couldn't get away from that. You're surrounded by men who, by their language or foul language, that was a sign of manhood to them. All right? And I would not doubt, because you were not cussing, you were looked down upon. And that's just in that environment, that's the way it's handled. And there's a strong influence to join. And it is, and that's where you have to be rooted in the Word, in our convictions, as Mary was saying, just remembering who we are so that we can make that stand of just not joining in what we might even eventually get to the point, well, that's harmless, when it's not. Because it damages us. I mean, well, let me ask you: when you were in the Navy, was it the were you separated out just because of language? Forget even your faith, but just for language. And did you have did you feel a lot of pressure to join in?
I will say this: I grew up around here. Okay, everybody I knew was a believer. Everybody had been saved at early age. Everybody would say the right words, and there was a cultural standard. You know, this was in the 60s and 70s. And suddenly I was in a spot with 500 other people plus other people none of which believed any of that. And the Lord actually used that in my case. It was such a startling difference because, let's face it, when I was growing up, even though people said the right words, they didn't do the right thing. The men drank, men cursed, men ran around with the new loose women, and they talked about it, and I heard it, and I was exposed to it. And yet they still said they were Christians and still went to church on Sunday. Here I am surrounded by a bunch of people who didn't believe any of that. And it was such a startling change. That was probably a defining moment in my spiritual growth. And so, all right, Lord, I'm not of the world. I understand that. And, yeah, I got made fun of a little bit. It didn't really bother me a whole lot. I was probably too ignorant to pick up on a lot of the nuances and the side glances and the smirks behind the hand. I don't know. But yeah, they would offer me things. There was a very big enticement to get Petty Officer Worrell to do this or go here. And I would like to say to my credit, but mostly it was because I was too poor to do any of it. Probably had something to do with it. I did succumb. But their communication was quite enticing at times. You're dismissed.